My name is Joe Martin, and this session is on building a multicultural church. In some ways, there's a little bit of a potpourri, hodgepodge of things that are, which I believe are very important for people who are thinking about the question of building a multicultural church. Let me say the three things that I'd like to present briefly today, and then also take into serious consideration of if that doesn't include anything that you'd hope we talk about, that we add some things to it. Three pillars: JNLC and PMD. Got that? Now, anybody want to talk about anything else? I want to talk about the fact that there are three structural pillars in the new ELCA that make it possible and give opportunities for us to build a multicultural church in the ELCA that we've never had before. And they are the Commission for Multicultural Ministry, the Commission on Women, and the constitutionally defined rules for representation, for inclusive representation. So I want to talk about them in a little bit of detail. Secondly, I want to talk about the work of grassroots justice agenda organizations in helping to make that happen. Those of us who are outside the official responsibility of the institution, but through grassroots work, and JNLC stands for Justice Network in the Lutheran Church, of which I happen to be co-coordinator, and that's a network of 30 justice agenda grassroots organizations in the church. I'd like to describe that a bit, and then thirdly, PMD is Pension Members for Divestment. One of the most concrete issues we have to work on is the issue of divestment of our church's investment portfolio from South Africa, as well as other screens, justice agenda screens, but especially kind of a fundamental ticket to the game, for some of us at least, we believe, is in terms of identification, solidarity with South Africa, and being a church that confesses a commitment to work for multicultural justice. A fundamental starting place is whether or not my pension money, is going to be made on the blood of South Africans. And there's a campaign for that taking place. So
I'm already there. My pension is.
Is divested?
No, I mean, I'm a part of this.
Oh.
When I read it in the Lutheran, I was just aghast.
Aghast, right. Well, I want to give a little historical background about how we were aghast so much, because we had hoped it would be taken care of in that decision, and we would be not have to be gearing up for another major, probably 3-year-long campaign that's coming up. So there are three principal issues about the struggle, the opportunities, and the problems that I believe to be three of the principal ones we need to talk about in terms of outlining what it means to build a multicultural church. Now, you need to add some agendas and some things you'd like to talk about, so we get at least get a smattering of touching of all of them. Anything else that you had hoped to talk about? If not, we'll proceed. One other thing we might want to end up in, if I get through these fairly quickly and to everyone's satisfaction, is the question of congregational multicultural church, what it means to build on a congregational level, work at being multicultural. With the nodding of your heads, I think that might just be added as a, without any question. Let's make sure we spend some time talking about that.
And Joe, is the greater church body looking at multicultural in terms of a more balanced set of numbers? Are they looking at a lot of the urban churches too, to try to get mixes, much like schools are trying to integrate? What is kind of the objective?
Well, a lot of that hasn't been decided yet. But one objective that has been made is something that seems almost ludicrous when you start thinking about it, an increase of reaching 10% non-white Lutherans within 10 years. And if you put that in the level of, if you just put that on the level of new congregations, it would mean starting a new congregation every week of people of color in order to get that between now and the time. What it really, if it's possible to do that, it means every place where it's possible of existing congregations reaching out, and it's possible that this would begin to happen into their neighborhoods, into the people that they are serving, and become themselves multicultural churches in membership. So that's one concrete piece, but there's an awful lot that hasn't been decided. We've been living with an image of circles and dots for the last couple of weeks. And let me start off by saying this. It comes from Dr. Alpero, who's been with us all last week. Any of you here for Dr. Alpero last week? Who helps us to understand something of the of what it means to be when a truly rainbow church that is structured on the basis of justice and equality. And it means getting over some of what is. What is and has been for far too long in the church and in the rest of society is a multicultural statement that looks like this. The white society and white institutions as the powerful ones in the middle, and if anybody wants to relate to that, like black, brown, Native American, and Asian, then they have to operate through the central structure. Even in relating to each other, it goes through that way rather than communicating directly with each other. That is not a rainbow. That is not a church structure or in terms of what the baptismal promises have promised. Nor is it any kind of an institution, whether it's church or secular, which allows for justice to take place. The restructuring of that into something that fulfills the promises is where each one of these are equal circles, white, black, brown, Native American, and Asian, and with all of the opportunity for full cross-cultural action and activity. The one in the middle is one that I think is extremely important also to learn, because there's a danger of not going from this to this as we should, but doing it halfway. And that is saying, okay, y'all don't like to do it through us, let us help you create a ghetto in which you all can just simply deal with each other and we'll still do our thing out here, and the relationship still will be, and there's some improvement to that. And certainly the Commission for Multicultural Ministry has a responsibility of, and there's a desk ministry for each one of those groups to ensure that ministry will take place amongst black people, brown people, red people, yellow people in more effective ways. But if the white is just set outside of that like that, then it just continues to be a segregated church. And this is the image that Dr. Perro holds up for us to base our structural relationships to each other. That's very helpful kind of imagery, I think. And I think all of us can identify this as being our normal experience. And it's not hard to project and get excited about that being the way it could happen. The only thing is, and if we have time and desire, we can talk more about this, that you do see in going from here to there, who has to make most of the changes. We too often think about doing ministry among people of color as what can we do to help them change. But you can look at this image, can't you, and see who has to do most of the changing? Who has to go through, be willing to be changed and to operate in new ways most? And that's us. So that we can structurally place ourselves within a circle of friends and in a circle of equality and justice. So it won't necessarily be an easy thing for just to vote for this and say, okay, now let's start doing it. It means our learning a whole new way of acting and caring about the way we do that. If you see the video that's going to be shown at Second Lunch, Cry of Reason, The Life of Dr. Bears Naudet, a man who whose principal question alongside of will there be an end of apartheid and full power and participation in the government by people of color is his caring, loving caring for what happens to white people in the process. How do we adjust our lives so that we can be in a new way? Okay? If I want to stay on that for a little while longer? I'll come back to that if we need to, but let me come to the three, quickly go through as quickly as possible into the three things I wanted to say about our new way of being together, in which this becomes then the framework by which we struggle to make some of this happen. How many of you already know at least something about the Commission for Multicultural Ministry or the Commission for Women or the rules for representation in the Constitution? Has anybody here been involved in any of that at all or know previous to now much about that at all? Okay. Commission for Multicultural Ministry. For the first time in the history of any Lutheran church, and maybe for most other denominations too, I would suspect, there has been institutionalized power for people of color. And that's a really important thing. It begins to see this kind of shift going over here, that the power relationships don't just simply are not dependent upon this. It's a full commission in which there is a desk staffed by a black director for black ministries, a desk staffed for Asian ministries, staffed by an Asian minister. Now, both of those were up here during this past week, both of those directors, Pastor Richard Perry and Pastor Bill Wong. Some of you must have met Bill Wong before he left on Tuesday, right? And then the other two, a Native American desk staffed by a Native American person for overseeing ministries amongst Native American peoples in the Lutheran Church, and Hispanic ministry likewise. And that at least gets us as far as this, institutionalized power for doing ethnic ministries. Now that Commission for Multicultural Ministry has another responsibility for leading the church in trying to get that image going in the rest of the church. In a very brief summary, that is what the Commission on Multicultural Ministry is about. It's directed by one of the finest leaders our church has, Pastor Craig Lewis, a black pastor who has, in the old LCA, was director of theological education, and is one of the most capable persons we have in the church. And he better be, because it's one of the most difficult jobs there is in the church in dealing not only with making this happen that's never happened before, and having the relationships among these develop in ways they've never developed before, but then also he's responsible for at least helping to make our shift, you know, some kind of a long-range strategy, us being able to shift our power center into being part of a equally shared power center. So pray for Craig Lewis and all of us as we do that.
Do those commissions abide by the same rules of representation of ratios of lay to clergy?
Yes.
And that type of thing?
Yes.
All four of those people are clergy or in some way?
As of now, half clergy and half lay. Right. The reason I hesitate on that is that Josefina Nieves, for the Hispanic desk, is acting director, and she won't be confirmed in that position for some time. But as of now, it's half and half, and it's half men, half women. There are other positions other staffing positions on the commission, which I won't go into because it gets complicated. But there's another four staff positions, and yes, they are obligated to. They're even obligated to have at least 10% people of color. They have 90% people of color. There is one full-time executive position that a white male is holding on the commission, and that is the assistant director to Craig. On the board of the commission, there are 20 people, 4 black, 4 Native American, 4 Asian, 4 Hispanic, and 4 white. And then following all the other representation too. I happen to be one of the white persons who's on that board. It's fun. It really is fun.
How often do they meet?
The board? Normally twice a year. I suspect we'll be meeting more often than that, at least portions of this at different times. It's a very complicated structure because each one of those beside a board, each one of those desks has an advisory committee of 9 people from the that's appointed by each community. The Black Association, it's called the United Lutherans for Black Concern, of Lutherans appoint 9 persons to an advisory committee to work with that desk person, and the same thing with the other 4. So it gets a very complicated, it's a complex task moving that to that. It's a complex task changing the power relationships that have existed for so long.
Joe, can I ask you a real basic question? How many Lutherans are people of color?
I'm trying to remember if the number that pops into my mind is 100,000. It's 0.0-something%. A long way to go before we get to 10%. But not an insignificant number in terms of when they are gathered together to see the power and feel the power that they have of because so often it's a token representation. If you have 2 black members of a congregation and you feel pretty alone, even more so if you're 1. and so there's a really wonderfully powerful spiritual experience that takes place, not only when there's a gathering of the communities of each of these, but every 2 years. There was one 2 years ago, last year, there's going to be one next year, of a celebration, a multicultural event that brings together all 4 communities to feel the life of their sharing with each other. It's really exciting.
What do you think about the quota and the overall structure?
Let me jump to that. Okay. Well, no, let me quickly pass down through and then come to the quotas, rules for representation. The second pillar for multicultural, inclusive, diverse church that makes a structural thing that we've never had to work with before is a commission on women. For the first time in the history of the Lutheran Church, there is institutionalized power for women. Now, there's been auxiliaries for a long time, and they are not powerless. But they have never been a part, and they still are not a part of the institutional structure of the church. So parallel to the women of the ELCA is a commission on women, or commission for women. Is it on or for? I always forget. It must be for. It's got to be for. Or of. In, by, with, and under. In which there is institutionalized structure for doing the same thing as the commission is to do for people of color. That is creating a structure by which women address ministry to women and ensure it, as well as to build a structure in which women and men are fully inclusive on a power level. And I think that's really important. When we talk about institutions, we're talking about equality of power. Then, thirdly, these are undergirded, all the other two, by another very important pillar that is constitutionally provided for. And I'm excited by it. My answer to that is that I'm very excited by it. Who asked that question? But I'd love to hear some of your feelings about it also. It has very controversial ruling of constitutionally ensuring that there will be representation of groups of people that are often excluded in the power structural relationships of the church. And that ensures that there will be 60% laity. Any of you ever felt that clergy have too much power in the church? There will be 50% women. There will be at minimum of 10% people of color. Now, the Constitution deals with that. It doesn't deal with other issues such as age and other ways of which there is not, doesn't go so far as that. But in those key issue areas, there are rules for representation. Take a few minutes, respond to your, how do you feel about that?
When I first read it, it was shock. I have a brother that's an electrical engineer. And when he was in representative of a department and had to hire people, it was the quota system. He had to hire a black man because he was black. And he was not qualified, did not do a good job, created a lot of problems. But he was black, and that was the system. So to transfer that to church organization was kind of, you know, the first glance was difficult for me to agree with. I have no objection to people of color being on different commissions and boards and all. But I have mixed feelings.
Okay. Others?
Do you think it's because he was black? I mean, he could have hired a white man and probably would have given him to save him a lot of trouble.
He didn't have the background, the education, the experience, and all those things. And
but would they have to hire a certain individual that didn't have these qualifications? Couldn't they go out and get someone that was better qualified, is what I'm saying?
Apparently he was the only one that... He was the only one that had applied.
Yeah, but I think that's a two-way street, because I think those people of color haven't had those opportunities, and they haven't had the initiative, or not the initiative, or what the word is, to go ahead and get that education, to get that qualification, where now they know those jobs will be open to them, and they therefore gives them more incentive, I think. And I have double feelings about that, because I have a child of color, and my child's Asian. I never want her to get a job just because she's Asian. But on the other hand, I really think the initiative therefore is there for these people to go ahead and get the education, get the qualification, and they've got a chance.
Let me ask four questions, or suggest four principles that are important for considering this. And I neither want to push us too fast past this, but also know that we're in a very limited kind of session. But see if these four questions help to delineate some of the issues behind that. First, the question, are there qualified persons, is the one we were just discussing now. Second, the question, which we don't ask often enough, what is qualified? I'll come back to each one of these in a second. Number three, can we develop more qualified people? And I'll come back to that one also. And fourth, let's say black at this point, but you can take Asian or Native American, any one of them. Is what happens when being black is a qualification? Go down all four of those for a second. Are there qualified people? Now, I don't know about the case in which you were talking about a few moments ago, whether there was only one. Our experience has been that we are so separated and segmented from our own constituencies of people of color in our own, whether it's church or an electricity plant or General Motors or whatever it may be, in terms of where we go looking for people. If you have a chance sometime while you're here to listen to Jody Kressman talk about employment in a city, the two basic pools
two basic tracks of employment, a basically a white one and a people of color one, that never even cross over to look at each other. And we say, when we say have we looked where there are qualified people, we probably look at the couple of people who get into the white pools rather than into the full available qualified pools of the whole other employment circle. So that is a question, whether or not there are qualified people. We've experienced this in the Lutheran Church, just in fulfilling this kind of stuff. The qualified people who have popped up that nobody ever knew that were there, especially lay people. Now that's true white things too, is the clergy runs so much in the church, and you start asking for qualified people and make being lay a qualification, therefore clergy aren't qualified. a whole new other thing opens up. So first question, are there qualified people? Second, what are the qualifications? There's a tremendous amount of cross-cultural things that are added. My experience is that when I've been on an all-white group for a while and then switched to a group of fully, or even if it's all-white males, that's where you make white male clergy, all white male clergy group, and then go to a group that is filled with lay people, people of color, women, and clergy together, the definition of what qualifications are necessary change. Just bring in people of color in and we'll find out that there are qualifications that people have that we never considered necessary before and now we'll never be able to live without again. Just the whole question of what's the list of qualifications changes when this new experience comes into our being of having a diversified people making decisions and acting together. Thirdly, somebody already said this, we live in a system that keeps the qualifications of people of color at a different level than whites just by a racist educational system. And so that to the degree there are not enough qualified people, then the question is, how can we build the programs of making the qualified? The fact that there are enough, the fact that they may have had to say there's no qualified person is a condemnation of our preparation systems, right. rather than whether or not, and so it's not a question, should I hire somebody just because they're black and not qualified, but rather, we must have black people on this, how do we make them qualified?
Right. I feel okay.
And then fourthly, my basic thing is, especially in the church, if baptism makes us a rainbow, then full color is required. And therefore, if a black or an Asian is not present, then the qualification is that they be black. Then it becomes a qualification, not just simply did you hire me just because I'm black? Well, that was one of the qualifications, yes. That was, in this case, one of the qualifications.
Proportionate to what?
Pardon?
Proportionate to what? If you're 10% of the group, you got 10% of the power positions, or, if there's 10 positions, you got 5 and somebody else got 5? It's proportionate to what? I suppose you want to say equal, then it's 5 and 5, or...
I'm sorry, well, I lost you.
Okay, you say black is a qualification, and it's the same thing, like you have 20 people on the board, and so 5 representatives of each color.
Yeah.
But the membership is not proportional to that, is what I'm saying.
Well, the membership of the congregation?
Yeah, membership of the congregation.
So you're saying that...
Yeah, how do you share power? That's
And there's no magic formula for that. The board of multicultural ministries, there's 5 of each, and so in each of those, it's a qualification that I be white in the one that I'm on. So I fulfill a qualification by being white. I'm supposed to have a few other qualifications too, and so always a danger because there's also a danger of getting somebody who got on who didn't have the qualifications, and the only qualification was white. And that's the same thing you were worried about in terms of black. So there's got to be more than that. But in this case, in the case of fulfilling rules for representation, if 50% of the people are to be women, then for 50% of the positions, it is a required qualification to be a woman. And that changes for me a whole vision of what that of what it means of saying do we hire him just because he's black? Yeah, I mean that was one of the major qualifications. And if you're white, you didn't qualify for that position. Requirement that we learn to structure ourselves to conform to our baptism.
I guess that's my problem. We're jumping from A to C. Are we ready to go so fast? Are there enough women who are ordained today?
Well, interestingly enough, there is no qualification. They have not built rules for representation for ordained women at this point because there are not enough. So that they asked that question themselves, can we go that fast? And they said no.
How many ordained women are there?
Less than 1%. So if you said 50% of the clergy had to be women. We'd have to have every woman would have to take 9 board jobs in the church. And so it's so. But in every other case so far, and that's to our shame. That's to our shame. We work harder quickly. But in every other sense of the word, and there, if you take away the clergy thing, there are more than enough qualified women. Yeah. There are just as many qualified women as there are men. There are plenty of qualified people of color to fulfill 10%. There are more than enough qualified laity.
I think to skip over to how does this apply to your congregation, I can see some real exciting possibilities. We come from Seattle where we have a wonderful pool of multicultural people in our city. And our university congregation, which is supposed to be a more progressive congregation in the city, has very much a low quota of multicultural people in it. Although we aspire to having a multicultural church, we certainly don't at this point. And thinking about, is black a qualification for a position of power in the church? I think maybe that's the direction we need to be going right now within our church, and that might be to go to some of the, I don't know exactly how we'd go about it, but if our congregation could actively seek just a person who is black and give them a position of power in our church and explain to them, we really are aspiring to be a multicultural church. Could you help us? And put them on the board or put them on the church board and get the power just in that way, just as a qualification. Because that person could help us just by his very blackness and by his, or Asian or Hispanic or whatever, could help us grow a lot.
Even in doing that, we would grow a lot, just because we have a hard time doing that in a non-patronizing way.
Right.
It's just the learning of doing, of participating in the empowering of people in ways that are themselves not patronizing is very difficult. But that's certainly the right direction to be moving, I believe. Mm-hmm. So long as the natural flow of volunteer staff to Holden do not produce enough plumbers, then you have to make some rules for plumber representation or Holden's plumbing won't get taken care of. And I think if we're talking about that within the context of restructuring ourselves to conform to our baptism or restructuring our nation to conform to minimal rules of justice, then the same kind of thing has to apply.
I'd like to make a comment about qualifications. Yeah, I'm in an academic setting at the University of Washington. Seems like we get too smart too late about what we think is qualified in terms of the academic sense. And we've evolved to a system where we de-emphasize somebody's training and curriculum vitae, which may be 15 pages long or longer. We're now more interested in people that can relate well to other faculty and students, mm-hmm. that are compassionate and other things. And then that seems to take care of itself in terms of effective teaching. So we spend a lot more time now evaluating the individual and how they can relate with where their heart's at than we are reading a 15-page curriculum vitae.
Absolutely.
And the same could be in the church. You think you're looking for somebody qualified when you may be looking at the wrong thing.
That's right. That's the second thing. What is qualified? That's a perfect illustration of that. And certainly women and people of color both bring to us white males a whole new understanding of what qualifications are. We've been in control, determining 15 pages worth of degrees is what makes you qualified.
Yeah.
And we're just learning it just ain't so. That's not what
some of our biggest bonds have the best CV.
That's right. One other clarification I should make so there's not misunderstanding of this. The constitutionally based rules for representation do not apply to congregations. We can't and shouldn't impose that on congregations. We would not be able to if we wanted to. I would love to see the model for congregational constitutions be developed so that we're an option and more congregations choose that. To say that's what they're at least working towards. That would be exciting. This applies to synods, regions, and national church.
I'm full of mixed emotions, but I have one question. Where did the initiative for this come? Did it come from the whites, or did it come from the people of color, or the Asians, or I mean the Hispanics, or the other groups? Do you know? For this deep restructuring?
There's no simple answer to that. It came from both.
Because my experience is we're working with Hispanic ministry in Southern California. And the pastors of the Hispanic churches want their own synod. And I'm just wondering if we're imposing, I don't know what. I mean, this sounds idealistic, having, you know, the last group there. But on the other hand, we have to be careful, too, how we try to restructure something. And, of course, we have to have them in on it to be able to tell us how to do it. But a lot of Hispanics want their own churches. They, you know, in Spanish, their Spanish music, they want their service.
You're and talking about congregation? They want their own congregation?
Yes.
They want their own synod?
Yes.
And synod.
They've mentioned that.
Yeah.
But maybe they wouldn't if they felt like that the church body was more responsive to their needs. Maybe they wouldn't feel the need for their own church.
On the other hand, if Spanish is the first language, that's where they're going to feel most
comfortable.
That's right. Listening in, but the synod, you know, where they're bothering. But in the church itself, if Spanish is the first language, and that's what they understand.
Right. But not as they become more acculturated.
Yeah, a second generation or, you know, maybe migrants.
But there are a lot of migrants, or a lot of people that are human. There's a big immigration into Southern California of people that can't even speak English. And so I think we have to be careful with our restructuring also.
Yeah.
And we have a good idea, and even this whole idea of being baptized, you know, that's right. But looking at it realistically, we have to see that we're not imposing something that maybe...
I'm aware of the movements for and some of the... feelings about amongst Hispanic ministries that go far as far as to wish they had their own synod or their own church, and it exists also in the black. And most of that is because of their negative experience, especially the Hispanic congregations that are experiencing the racism while they're housed in white congregations. That they're not receiving and building equal relationships. And there are some advantages that they talk about if they really had a separate synod, like the language problem. But ultimately, they would really wish for a just relationship that permitted them to feel empowered in the synod that they belong. Let me say a little bit about the process of how this came into being, because it gets into the history a little bit of JNLC. There were 70 people who made the commission for a new Lutheran church, who were appointed to from the three church bodies to form the new Lutheran church, the ELCA, out of whom these proposals all came. What was really exciting is that there was a movement they came out of the grassroots, people who were involved in justice agenda organizations, as well as people within the structures, who said that that commission needed to be inclusive. That the kind of church we're dreaming about for the future would not be created by a commission of predominantly 70 white male clergy. And so there was a movement, a successful one, that changed an awful lot. There was a movement, a lobbying campaign to request, and then finally to get the ruling, that the new commission for a new Lutheran church, the CNLC, would be 70 people following the rules for representation of 60% laity, 50% women, and 15% people of color. That was a shock to the white male clergy who knew they would be called upon to construct the new Lutheran church. There are people, neither the ALC nor the LCA nor the AELC are very old. All of them have been created within our generation. And therefore the people who created them, which were mergers of others' churches, were already experienced merger people. And they were mostly white male clergy, the fathers, if you will, of our church. And so it would be an automatic conclusion that their experience would be needed and that they would form the new church. And that the CNLC would be predominantly 70 of them, with token representatives of other groups. The exciting thing that happened was that it became the rules for representation were used, which means a good representation of those types did get on there. Some of the most excellent people, but half of the 70, 35 to 40 of them came from other, had other qualifications other than, are you an experienced white male clergy at merging? And they went two meetings that went very well. And those two meetings sort of went under the assumption, and I'm not being nasty when I say that, but I am characterizing a little bit when I say this. The first two meetings operated sort of like those experienced with merging, namely the white male clergy, saying to these new people, don't worry, we'll show you how to do it. The third meeting, all hell broke loose.
Is that right?
In which the other 35 felt the patronizing, felt the need for their own qualifications being used, felt the realization that it's not just simply the old experience, but new creativity, and that everybody had something to give. You know, St. Paul's, you know, would let us all have gifts and use them. And asserted that, began to assert that. By the time they reached the fourth meeting, there was a motion on the floor to disband. To go tell the people that formed that group that they couldn't do it. I mean, that's how much we have to learn. Or that's the pathway all of us have to be willing to go through. The pain of going from here to here is not easy for us. It's never been easy for me, and I'm just still a beginner. But the motion never got a second. Somebody said, wait a minute, let's talk. But it was the kind of power expression that needed to be felt. By the next meeting, they were starting uphill. And there's not a person, probably not a single person, there may be a couple, of those 70, who would not now say it was one of the most meaningful, changing, creative, empowering experience of their life to be on that and to have gone through that and to learn to work together in new ways with people with new qualifications. A new definition of what it means to be qualified. So out of that experience then became people who said, we have to build a multicultural church. It can't be just us 70. And those proposals came out of that. Plus one other group. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of organizations in our churches that are not officially part of the institution. They're grassroots, especially grassroots justice agenda organizations. Just so that we know we're talking about the same thing, name some of the ones you know. Just name an independent movement or independent organization that's justice related in the Lutheran Church that's not created by the institution that you know about?
That was at the meeting the other day, so I had a little list off.
Oh, you got it. Okay, anybody, before she cheats, anybody else? Anybody else, do you know of? I'm sure when she starts to read her list, your mind will get jogged and say, oh yeah, I know six of them. Okay, name a couple.
Lutheran Peace Fellowship.
Anybody know about the Lutheran Peace Fellowship? Out of an independent peace organization out of Minneapolis. The director of it is a name you'll recognize, Tom Witt. Happens to be the son of the director of Holden Village. What's the next one?
Lutheran Human Relations.
Lutheran Human Relations Association? No? Okay, one. It's both of these two are very, very old organizations. Old in the sense of got created in the 30s and 40s. Lutheran Peace Fellowship became a gathering and an organizing of conscientious objectors in World War II. The Lutheran Human Relations Association was the first, when the Lutheran Church wasn't even willing to talk about how do we develop a multicultural church, there was a gathering of some folk in an independent movement who wanted to talk about it. Andrew Schultze, the hero of many of us who began to form that organization. More.
Lutheran Concerns for Gay Rights.
Anybody ever hear of Lutheran Concerned? One of the, we're not at a point yet where there's an institutional place for the rights of gay people in the Lutheran Church. And so gay Lutherans have formed an organization called Lutherans Concerned for gay and lesbian rights in the Lutheran Church.
National Namibia Concerned.
National Namibia Concerned. Somebody nodded your head? Yeah. Denver, Colorado. One of the most exciting organizations that, given the fact that Namibia is something like 90% Lutheran, Southwest Africa, some of you may know it as, a colony of South Africa, in effect, that's searching for its freedom, and which our church has a very important relationship to, and this wonderful organization that works for Namibian rights.
Lutheran Women's Caucus.
Lutheran Women's Caucus, alongside with the official institution, there's also a grassroots organization called Lutheran Women's Caucus in the Lutheran Church. Go ahead.
Lutheran Coalition on Latin America.
Uh-huh. Pastor Susan Berkelow, who is here teaching on teaching staff right now, who happens to also be my wife, is the coordinator of a grassroots group of people working for in solidarity with people working for justice in Latin America.
Lutheran Border Concerns.
Lutheran Border Concerns. Why don't you just read the list now?
Well, I only have one more. Okay. Holden Village, and there are 30. I didn't get it. You didn't say
a Holden Village is a member of. Holden Village is a grassroots organization. It was never created by the Lutheran Church. It's a grassroots group of people who's concerned about your and my growth, an opportunity for growth and understanding of the faith, especially in the area of justice. There are dozens and dozens of organizations in the organization called Justice Network in the Lutheran Church, which I'll give you some newsletters in a second. There are 30. It includes also the associations, the grassroots associations of these four groups, United Lutherans for Black Concerns, the Asian Lutheran Association, the Native American Lutheran Association, and the Hispanic Association, all of whom are not created by the institution of the church, but are Lutherans who come together as grassroots movements to represent their issues from the grassroots and to be in relationship to the institution. This group came into being about 4 years ago and became, and we even used JNLC because it was nice poetically, alongside CNLC, the Commission for the Lutheran Church and Justice Network in the Lutheran Church, representing, and this is still answering the question, who decided, representing and became very close friends with those 35 new people on the CNLC. We referred to them as our friends on CNLC. By the time we were finished, all 70 were our friends, but became sort of a chaplaincy to CNLC, helping to give grassroots opinion to the creation of these three things. We don't have too much time. I'll just, when we're through, I want to ask as many of you want to come and take a newsletter of JNLC so you know something more about it, as well as take a look at a directory that we're putting out now in JNLC every year, a directory of Lutheran ministries for justice that are in the institution as well as in the grassroots, and that we'll be doing that every year. I'd like to take a chance of the opportunity to also risking a little bit of the confusing of talking about too many things in one session and just say something for 5 minutes about pension members for divestment, because this becomes sort of you'll be hearing many things, I'm sure, about all of these things as time goes by, but to have at least each one of these mentioned. Primarily the pension monies of the church, and that goes into billions of dollars. When you take the something like 10,000 pastors or more of the ELCA, but also the endowment monies and other foundation monies of the church, all of them gets into multi-billion dollars. All of them get invested into stocks and bonds while they're being held. It happens in every church. The issue that has, and there is a board of pensions that does the investing. The issue that for those of us in the church who have been concerned about solidarity with South Africa for years and years and years has been, should that money be invested in corporations that are invested in South Africa? Should, in the most blatant terms, should my pension money, or somebody said you're already getting pension, should your pension money come from profit made on the apartheid system, come from money that subjugates other people? Then there are other questions that are related to that, like should we be investing our money in corporations that make nuclear weapons, for example? Some things have already been decided long ago. That board of pensions would not invest any of our money in liquor, in liquor manufacturers, or in pornography, or in cocaine. There's great profits. We'd double our pension if we invested in cocaine. But they've decided ahead of time that we won't do that. So it's not like this is a new question. The question is, will the money investment be taken out of corporations that refuse to get out of South Africa? In the old churches, before the merger, we had this struggle, and in the ALC at least, we had won that. And they had decided that they would withdraw on a gradual basis all the money invested in South Africa. And the LCA was still in progress, but it hadn't been completed. And now we're starting all over again because there's a new board of pensions. And you said you were shocked. I was shocked too. I was at the meeting, and we were part of a grassroots organization called Pension Members for Divestment, helping to bring that issue up and saying that we represent a strong group in the ELCA who want disinvestment. And the will of the church, we thought, had been very, very clearly stated. The Constituting Convention of the ELCA, anybody who was there? The Constituting Convention of the ELCA in Columbus last fall voted almost unanimously to state that they did not want any of the pension money invested in South African corporations. And since that time, the church council and most of the boards of the church and so forth, and we had thought that the question would be answered. And then they had their board meeting and they said no. And we have a board of pensions that is technically and legally independent, so that anything the church says to them is only advice. And I just need for you to know, and we don't have a chance to go into great detail about it, but the newsletter also talks about that, so you can read about that. That there's now, because they said no, now it's necessary to have a major organizing project to make sure that the next time they're asked, hopefully next year this time, that they'll change their mind. Or maybe we even need to change the Constitution so that when a church convention votes for the Board of Pensions to do something with our money, that they have to listen, rather than say, no, I'm sorry, we're independent. I wanted to say that, so that's the three pieces. So. That's a lot. Any more responses you'd like to make? Sorry, was that part of? Yeah.
No, just talk about that.
Oh, talk about it.
Why would they say no?
Pardon?
Why were they saying no?
Is it profitable or something for them to stay in?
Their reasons for it that they said are very, I think, don't say the whole story, but they said, number one, that their first priority is to make money for pastors. That's what they are supposed to do, and that any decision which risks not making money for pastors is their responsibility to say no to. Now, we believe that that's not true, that they have another responsibility to pastors. Otherwise, they should invest in cocaine. I mean, that's very clear to me that if that's true, then I want them to invest in cocaine. Go see General Noriega with all of our money. And secondly, in response to that, they have 10 years ago when I was helping to start this organizing around this issue, we only guessed at something. Now we know for certain. At that time, we guessed that which is called technically a South Africa free portfolio could make just as much money as one that invests in South Africa. But it was just a guess. We were very bold in those days. We said, yeah, we absolutely insist it can be done, but we had no proof. Now all the proof is there. They made 10 years of study, and it's clearly, publicly, there's no one who denies this is true. That a South Africa free portfolio can make as much money as a South African portfolio. So their first reason is, however, that they are first of all bound to do only that which makes money for my retirement. The second reason they say is because they would be breaking the law. There are rules there are laws, federal laws, not church laws, that control investors, and they came into being because investors were ripping off people's when you're responsible for investing people's money, and they were taking it off the top and investing in Las Vegas, you know, things like that back in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and the 50s when all these laws came into being. And these laws are very, very good in terms of controlling investors so that they don't make their own private money on them. They're called the laws for fiduciary responsibility. And they claim that they are afraid that if they divest from South Africa, that they are violating the federal laws on fiduciary responsibility. This is a debatable issue, but there are some lawyers who say, yes, that's true, and there are some lawyers who say, no, that's not true. The fact is, there have been hundreds of organizations that have divested from South Africa. State governments, like the state of Massachusetts, universities, unions, and some churches, and not one of them has been accused of breaking the law yet. Actually, that's not true. Two of them have been accused of breaking the law. Somebody brought a lawsuit to them, and both cases have been thrown out of court.
What about the claim that we're really harming the South African market?
That you have to ask South Africans. We had, among many, many, many others, we had Dumisani Kumalo in South Africa here as a resource person.
That's right, he was at our church.
No, Farisani.
No, Farisani. Farisani was going to come, and then he's at a torture hospital this month and couldn't come. And so Dumisani Kumalo too. Farisani and Kamala's answers are identical as anybody you ask who has been working for the South African government.
They say they couldn't suffer anymore.
That's right. They said,
oh, that's right.
If you were if the South Africa was really worried about black South Africans suffering, they wouldn't have apartheid. And if we're worried about Dumasani's powerful answer, he says, if you're really as worried about our suffering, then it's really strange that the same amount of suffering that takes place in the United States isn't taken seriously. But most important, they said, we're suffering already through this system. The question is, what will ultimately stop our suffering? And that is not make apartheid more humane, but stop apartheid. You know, to continue to investing in apartheid at best makes slavery more human rather than stopping slavery. And the people who ask that question don't make that distinction. The South African blacks are willing to do whatever is ever necessary for their freedom and ask us to do the same.